But this shows the basic problem we're working on in my lab. We call morphogenesis, and this shows a typical, what we call a chordate. And I'll describe what a chordate is in a minute. But really simply, what we're the difficulty is how you go from something like this. This is frog egg, a couple hours old. I've colored it so you can see these different parts. So basically, how we go from this round, fairly uniform-looking ball of cells into ultimately something like a swimming tadpole. Won't go into the details, but you'll see early on a bunch of things are happening. For example, a process called gastrulation, where this blue tissue here will make up ectoderm, ecto on the outside surrounding it, give rise to skin and nervous system. This will encapsulate the embryo. Meanwhile, this red tissue here, making what's called mesoderm, meso in the middle, and here, this will give rise to things like skeletal muscle, something called a notochord skeleton, a number of tissues. This will end up in the middle, and then this other tissue here, endoderm, gives rise, endo on the inside, gives rise to gut and various things like that. So how is this process regulated, and what we're most really interested in is how you go from this to giving this elongated shape. So how you really take on a shape of the tissue. I said chordates. So what's a chordate? This shows a prototypical chordate. I'm a chordate, and you're a chordate. We're all chordates here. And these are the basic characteristics. One is this tissue called a notochord. It's here. This is something you no longer have, but used to have one when you were an embryo. And talk a lot about the notochord. And it's really this notochord giving rise to the main chordate. So animals that have a notochord are chordates. You find another number of other characteristics. A dorsal hollow nerve cord, dorsal meaning on the back. So here's the nerve cord here. Pharyngeal gill slits. You probably don't have them anymore, but you've had them at one time. They're shown here. Most obviously going from a fish. Blocks of muscle here. The segmented muscle. And a post-anal tail. Here's the end of the gut. And here's this tail that extends out. So the notochord. We're very interested in the notochord in my lab. You'll see here. So it forms this flexible but stiff rod, provides internal support. This really is a scaffold on which you build the embryo. In early development, we'll see that it's really responsible for shaping a lot of the embryo. And I'll show you when the development of the notochord fails, the whole elongation of the body, much of the development of the embryo fails. So this is really driving a lot of it. As I said, it's usually only present in embryos. There are some exceptions. Some fish keep it as an adult. But that's more of the exception.
Is there a relation between the notochord and the spinal cord?
No. So the spinal cord is coming from a similar tissue that gives rise to these muscle here. It's called a somite. So there are these segmented structures. Part of it gives rise to the skeletal muscle. Part of it goes on to give rise to the skeleton, which includes the vertebrae. There's a few cells in the notochord that actually do persist into the adult, but no longer is a recognizable rod structure. Most of it just dies and goes away.
So what would be the chordate and not the vertebrae that do that?
I'm getting there. Ah. Okay, so this is actually one of them. This is an ascidian, and what I want to show you here is why the notochord is so important. So this is about, let's see, about 12 hours, it works, 12 hours of development we're just filming. So initially we're starting out with this little ball here that's just dividing up, not doing much, but soon you see where the notochord really comes into play. Notice this mass here. This is the notochord forming, and now you see how the tail is really elongating out like this. And pushing out, and there we go. So here's the notochord here, right down the middle. And these are ready to swim away. So you'll see when this notochord development fails, this whole body shape doesn't take place. It's really structuring the body. So what are these, as Boris said? So I said chordates here. This shows for all of the what's called metazoan animals. They're clustered into three big groups. You're probably familiar with Drosophila from the Experimental Animals. That's an arthropod. C. elegans is a nematode. this part of the group called Ecdysozoa. There's another very large group of animals that really poorly studied called Locotrophozoa. But these include things like mollusks, squids, and so on. Not extensively studied. And then the smallest, most insignificant group of metazoan animals is this one here, which includes us. We're chordates within this group called the deuterostomes. Our closest relatives, you probably wouldn't guess, are echinoderms, which are starfish, sea urchins, sea cucumbers, and an animal you'll never meet called a hemichordate. It's called an acorn worm. They're strictly marine. They burrow in sand. You'll never meet one unless you go actually looking for one. And all this is very well substantiated based on molecular DNA analysis. So let's just blow up this region. And so here we go. Here's our chordate, or hemichordate, our echinoderms. Then here are the chordates. There's three subphyla of chordates. They're the boring kind called vertebrates, which include the fish, the mammals, the birds, the reptiles, everything we're familiar with. And there's two other subphyla. You probably never encountered them unless you own a boat, maybe, and keep it in the dock harbor and have to clean it. because one of these, the group we're working on, the urochordates, they're strictly marine, and if you ever see them, you'll probably find them living on the bottom of your boat. They form an obsidian. The other main group is this thing called a cephalochordate. There's only about a dozen species of these. These are distinct from the vertebrates. Again, they're strictly marine. You'll probably never see one of these unless you really want to. They're right out here, but they kind of burrow into the gravel and you never see them. Your chordates are actually a big group of animals. There's about 2,000 different species. Why are we working on these? Well, they have a couple great advantages for looking at morphogenesis. One is the genome is very small. So the genome of a urochordate is about 5% the size of a vertebrate genome. Cephalochordates, about 10% size. What appears to have happened, I'll show you how simple these animals are in a minute, but the split between these non-vertebrate chordates and the vertebrates, it appears as though the entire genome doubled several times, meaning that the genome replicated, and yet the cell didn't divide, so they ended up with twice as much DNA. And that seems to have happened twice. So what you find in vertebrates relative to these invertebrate chordates is not, you find more genes, but not entirely new gene species, but big gene families, meaning many variations on a theme within a gene, which seems to be the result of this duplication. And that's how vertebrates got so complicated. And in fact, fish seem to have done that one additional time. So fish probably have more genes than we do. By duplicating your genome, what you get is all this fodder for evolution, which is why probably there's such variety in fishes and there's so many weird fish out there, is that they have so much DNA to work with. That they can now mutate versions of genes, keep the original one doing the original function, and so on. So that's one of the reasons why we're interested in the urochordate. Small genome, few number of genes, small gene families, and very few cells. So this shows, again, a frog tadpole. This is one of these ascidian tadpoles. These are both approximately the same stage. This is a free-swimming, complete organism. It's only about 2,600 cells. It's about, compared to about 20,000 for frogs, the nervous system is only about 330 cells. And as I'll hopefully I'll get to, the layout of the nervous system and the basic structure is very vertebrate-like, but yet very few cells. But this is a complete nervous system that has sensory input, integrates that information, makes decisions based on it, and so on. Muscle, only 36 muscle cells. This could have hundreds and hundreds of muscle cells. And again, back to the notochord, it's only 40 notochord cells. This one is carrying a transgene that's expressed only in the notochord and makes it glow green. So we can see the notochord here. So that's one cell there, that's one cell there.
Is it always 40 cells, or is that a
right? In this animal, it's always 40 cells. So that's the other beauty of these animals versus these is that there's a fixed and well-characterized cell lineage. So we can go back to the early developmental stages, 8 cells, 16 cells, and say, this cell is going to go give rise to these tissues. It can't be that with vertebrate embryos. They're too complicated, and there seems to be this sloppiness to it. And I'll show you a slide where that really comes in well for making models of how different structures develop.
Do you have a number of cells completely deterministic?
Completely deterministic, as far as we can tell, yes. Not all 2,600 cells have been mapped. The nervous system has been mapped. The muscle has been mapped. The notochord, the gut cells have the actual skin cells, and there's a lot of very small skin cells. No one has worked out completely lineage on that. But it may very well be. There's some groups that now want to start doing this full type of lineage analysis, which is the C. elegans, to really make this dendrogram that shows where every cell comes from.
You were talking about the duplication of genes.
Mm-hmm.
Does it happen right after the experience, or is it simply sharks?
It appears as though it includes the sharks as well, and even the hagfish and lampreys, which are sort of further down in the vertebrate. They seem to, at least as far as they've looked, that they seem to have this duplication.
So it's
just a Yeah. The hallmark that people usually use for looking at this duplication is what's called the Hox cluster. Mm-hmm. And ascidians have a single Hox cluster like their software does, whereas humans have four. Fish seem to have somewhere between six and eight. And lampreys seem to have four. But the lamprey is a very primitive dominant fish.
The difference is that it's a full genome.
That's very controversial.
I heard before a story about the
Hox cluster. It's very controversial because when you look at the whole sequence genome of the vertebrates versus, for example, these animals, some people look at that and say, yes, obviously there was a whole genome duplication. Other people say, look at it and say, no, there were limited duplications within it. There certainly aren't four obvious, what we call orthologs of every gene. So those who support that idea say that after the duplication, there was massive loss and rearrangements, so it's very hard to see. Must be Wayne. Okay. Yes.
Right.
So that's. One would guess. No, I mean, I think it partially has to do with. Presumably, this one would back here, this original animal. So I think it's a conserved trait that goes back here. And it's been preserved here, it's been preserved there as they got more complicated. It seems partially to do with how many cells there are. For example, in C. elegans, you'll often find organs that really have composed of just one cell. And we see the same thing in ascidians, where often there's one cell doing something, where in vertebrates there'd be a whole cluster of big tissue. There's enormous nematodes, parasitic ones, and do they? I don't know. They all obviously start out as small embryos. I should ask Joel this. There's a lineage up to a certain point, and then they lose it. And I'm not being entirely honest with you either regarding ascidians. Because this is the larval form here. This will then go through metamorphosis and turn into this animal that's no longer recognizable as a chordate. They're about this big, whereas these guys are about a millimeter long. They'll go through metamorphosis and grow extensively. After that point, we don't think they have a fixed lineage. At least it would be hard to, they go from thousands to probably millions and millions of cells. It'd be extremely difficult to show that they did. But yet this is a complete organism here that does have a fixed lineage. Let's see. So back to the notochord. So again, this shows the sort of the beauty and the simplicity of the ascidian embryo. These are what's called confocal images, where we're just staining the boundaries of cells. This shows going from an early kind of spherical embryo. I've highlighted the notochord cells in red, and eventually they'll form the single cell column just like this. And note here, it's bounded by muscle, so I'll come back to muscle in a minute. And there really seems to be two phases going on here. One, there's this convergence to the midline. So here's the future head, the tail, and then these are, you know, the right and left sides. And so they're starting out as this broad group of cells, and they come together to form this column. And that continues on here. And then I'll show you there seems to be a distinct difference between this convergence here and then this last step where they form a single cell column, which we're going to call intercalation. Then there's a third step that goes on. So you saw when I showed you that movie of the tail extending out, a lot of that tail extending out happens after this. So you can see that this process certainly is making the tail. These cells intercalate this, you're cramming them together, so it's going to extend this way. But after this, the tail continues to extend, and that's a whole different process. I'm sorry? Yes.
So the cells are proliferating throughout, or?
By about here, they've stopped. There's about 40 cells, yeah. Yeah, and then there's, so most of that elongate, in fact, really all of that later elongation where the tail and that movie is just shooting out, that is not cell growth. That is just changing the shape and the sizes of the cells.
Is this a two-dimensional sheet, or is there another axis?
This is a two-dimensional confocal. So it's sort of, they're spherical like this, and we're doing a section like this.
So there are more cells in this
cell. Yeah. This is, in fact, all of the notochord cells. They're round like this, and we're seeing a section like that. So there, are, in terms of the notochords, there's no more cells here or down there. Yeah. But they quickly become by this. Right. By this point, it's really a two-dimensional intercalation. But then something else goes on. So this is showing the notochord from the same animal. Here you see that's. I'm just showing them two different ways. This is just Nomarski, where we're just seeing an image of the cell, and I'm staining them so you can see the nuclei here. So that's one cell there. And so at this point, they've intercalated. Then I'm showing the same number of cells in each of these frames, and you'll see how the whole thing is getting longer and longer and longer. This is a process that all chordates do. You did this as well, that these cells start to puff up. So notice how the cell's getting fatter and fatter, and eventually the cell gets squished out here. So what's causing it to grow out like this is really sort of like a root growing. It's hydrostatic pressure, we think. No one's really proven it, but it seems to be hydrostatic pressure. What they do is they form little vesicles inside the cells. You can see them here, beginning to form here. Presumably it contains some sort of hyperosmotic fluid, draws in water, starts to swell up. There's connective tissue around the cylinder, so it can't puff out too much. And so the whole thing just shoots out like this and forms this column. And that's how you got to be sort of elongated like this, as well as these guys. And you can see it forming here. So this is really non-cellular material. It's this big vacuole, we'll call it. And eventually they'll fuse together, push all the cytoplasm out of the way. So that's a mature notochord. That's the cell. And then there's this cell-free space here, which is filled with this hyperosmotic fluid. And that's what's making it rigid. And that's what allows the larva to swim, is that you know, they'll contract muscles on one side, and this will kind of bounce back and forth, and that's how they swim. They were here, and then here they are, and then you start to form these vacuoles between them, and the whole cell just gets pushed up to the side. So that and that, from here to here, yeah. Yeah, it seems as though these get bigger and bigger, so those two touch and they fuse.
The cells that will become donuts.
The cells. Yeah.
It's now they turn into donuts.
But they're mostly these are forming right at the junction between the cells. So it's kind of this cup that's forming right in there, and then it just, because it can't extend that way, it extends this way, and then they will eventually fuse as this grows this direction, and that'll fuse to that and that.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is like, so the cell still spans the diameter of the cylinder.
No. Actually, it's true, because this...
And here it doesn't. So,
right.
Did it detach and sort of migrate to one side of the cylinder, or did it just form a donut?
Good question. So, for example, so this was one cell here. Does part of this cytoplasm end up here, and part of it end up there? Presumably, it's all... Yeah, so it would have to detach from one side, you would think, wouldn't you? And go over, yeah. So, in otherwise, you would split the cell in half. It's not known. This isn't...
And the bottom slide, the bright spots are nuclei, so
right.
Sort of staggered
right now. I'm assuming what's really happening is you'll have really the cytoplasm kind of smeared around underneath this sheath that coats the notochord, and that's, so it's still connected even though you have some of the cytoplasm here and some here, that there's kind of a thin layer of cytoplasm.
That's the donut.
Yeah, that's the donut, yeah. Yeah, it'd be nice if we could do this. This isn't true time lapse. This is just taking pictures. It'd be nice to see this in real time. So I said there's these three steps. One is this convergence, intercalation, and then this elongation as these vacuoles form. A biologist's way of figuring out how this works is to go in and start breaking things and see what happens. So what we have are mutations that affect these different processes. We seem to have one that affects, that disrupts each of these. Mutant called Chungmage, which disrupts this convergence. This was found by a Japanese postdoc. one called Aimless, turns out to be a gene called Prickle, which is in the planar cell polarity pathway, which disrupts this intercalation. And then one called Chobi, which is another Japanese name, which this process is disrupted. I won't talk about Chobi because we really don't understand it yet. We don't know what the gene involved is. For these two, we do know what the gene is. So first look at Chungmage. What I'm showing here is the notochord cells stained green because they're expressing a gene that makes them green, and it's only expressed in the notochord cells. And you'll see they're widely dispersed throughout the embryo. When we first saw this, we thought, okay, these cells are immobile and they're unable to converge together. But in fact, it's the opposite. So what I'm showing here is a number of these embryos about to undergo this tail elongation. This mutation is lethal, meaning that we can't make an adult that has it. So the only way we can make an adult is have it heterozygous. Animals are diploid, so you can have one good copy and one bad copy, and you're fine. If you cross two of these animals, a certain percentage of the progeny will get two bad copies, and they'll show the phenotype. So what this is the progeny of these two crossed animals. So some will be normal-looking, and some will be mutant. So for example, this is a normal one, and the notochord cells are glowing green here. You see this elongation. These are two mutants. And what you notice is the notochord cells, rather than being immotile, are just cruising all over the place. And in fact, I think the most interesting thing is they never stop moving around. They keep moving after their little wild-type siblings have swum away. So it's clearly not a problem with motility, something else. And they seem to be randomly moving around, trying to come together to form a coherent tissue, and they never do it. When we map this gene, it maps to something called laminin. And this just shows an in situ hybridization where we're looking at the cells that express this gene. And here's the forming notochord cell. So it's a gene that's in the notochord cell. It's not in the mutant down here. Even though these ones have a notochord, it just doesn't develop properly. What is laminin? Laminin is a horrible gene. It's one of the biggest genes I've ever had to work with. It's just enormous. And what it does is it forms a component in what's called a basement membrane. And a basement membrane separates tissues and cells adhere to it. This just shows a basic basement membrane. The laminin's here, part of this big complex that includes collagen, which gives it strength, and then connects from one cell surface here, there's something called the cell here. It's well known that the notochord here, so this is a picture of a fish embryo cut this way, looking down. So we see the notochord is round here, that the notochord is surrounded by one of these basement membranes. So what do we think is going on here? Our model is this, that early in development, the notochord cells are just randomly crawling around. The mechanism by which they do this is making lamellipodia. They send out processes that have filaments in them, and they grab hold of things, and they kind of bleb over like that. And they just kind of bleb out in every direction. And so they're just randomly crawling around. In that mutant I just showed you, they just never stop crawling around. In a normal embryo, what's going to happen is a basement membrane starts to form between the neighboring muscle cells and the notochord cells, and what we think is they get captured. So they'll cruise around until they get captured here, and these ones will keep cruising around until eventually they all get captured and you get them converging to the midline. So this seems to be enough to explain convergence is this capture, but that doesn't seem to be the whole process. There's this other mutation here, aimless. You'll see that here's in, can you see this down here? So I'm highlighting the notochord in red here, and this is that boundary that I'm talking about between muscle cells and notochord cells. And what you'll see in aimless is, for example, here's cells in the middle. By the time you're done with it, all of the cells end up getting captured at the boundary. So, but yet they can never go from this point to this point. So something else is missing. They can get captured, but yet they can't form the single-celled column. So this mutation ends up mapping to something called prickle, which is part of a signal transduction pathway for a extracellular signaling molecule called Wnt. I'm not going to go into the whole detail here. This is known as the planar cell polarity pathway, and prickle is here, and it interacts with a protein called disheveled. I'm going to show disheveled. Disheveled seems to be the key that signals through a number of proteins, significant one, rho A, ultimately acting on cytoskeleton and directing where the cell goes. This has been really well studied in Drosophila, regulates the polarity of eyes and wing cells. For example, prickle is because in the wing cells, there's little bristles on each wing cell. And you disrupt this, the polarity's gone, and all the bristles just stick up at random places, and they look sort of prickly. So all these, and disheveled looks a bit disheveled from their bristles as well. But this seems to also work in chordates and been implicated in polarized cell motility. So what we think is going on is that early on, there's sort of this random motion. So here I'm showing these early notochord cells. This red tuft is a lamellipodia, and this is how they're moving around. Eventually, it gets resolved into polarized, meaning directed, lamellipodia, and that's what's going to be pulling it together. So the basic model would be that you would have a signal coming from the outside of the cell saying, giving these cells in the notochord information, because what they want to do is intercalate like this, not like this. They want to go medial-lateral, and they don't want to move in a different direction. So they have to know which way to go. So how do they know which way to move is that a signal comes from outside, providing polarized information, and then this leads to polarized lamellipodia. At least that's the model. And that seems to be the case. So what we're looking at here is this is a notochord cell that we've isolated from this animal that we work on. And that's a lamellipodia there. That's what causes them to crawl around. When we look at the notochord cells from this mutant, they make just as many lamellipodia, so it's not as though they can't move, but they don't seem to send them in the right direction. So again, here I'm showing one of these embryos. Here's the future head. Here's the future tail, the posterior, the anterior. And here's the notochord cell field here. So what you want the cells to do is to converge medially to the middle here. So medial versus lateral. So through a lot of really painful microscopy, a postdoc in my lab, Di Jiang, counted lamellipodia in a normal embryo and one of these mutants. And what he found was that in a normal embryo, it's not an absolute thing. There's an approximately two-fold bias of extending out a lamellipodia this direction versus this direction. That seems to be enough to pull them together. Whereas in aimless, and hence the name, it doesn't seem to know which direction to go. Right.
So at the moment, I see many cells along the AP axis.
Right. So this is at the very beginning of the process.
So there will be polarization along the other axis as well.
At this point?
At the moment, what you're showing is a preferred crawling along the.
Along this direction, going medially, right?
Cross-section.
Mm-hmm.
The notochord is perpendicular.
Yeah, they'll run this way.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's along AP.
Along AP. So they'll all converge here to the middle from this side and this side. And they won't go this way because they're converging this way. And the extent... Okay.
So LM really is not an axis.
Yeah. It is an axis in the sense that...
This is really radial.
Right.
This is radial.
Right.
So, and polarization then is induced by this basal membrane?
No. Okay. So, the idea is, we said, these cells here have to know that they want to go this direction, they don't want to go this direction.
So,
yes.
So, if that's true, I mean, this ratio, asymmetric ratio, is that true also for cells in the middle or normally?
That's a really good question. That's what I've been begging, because it actually becomes very pertinent when you'll see the next slide. And this is an averaged over the whole embryo. And I've been begging the postdoc to do this, to go back and reanalyze this, because he's going to have to do it. Reanalyze, starting with new embryos, looking at lamellipodia here versus in the middle. Because I think you'll find a difference. And I think this full difference really is averaged over the whole thing. And that if we look at these ones versus these ones, it'll be a much greater difference. And you'll see why in a second. Okay, so the idea, we have to get information into this group of cells so it knows that they want to go this direction, they don't want to go this way. The planar cell polarity pathway would say that the signal is a wnt, and that wnt is coming from other cells, and it's that directional information that tells them where to go. So, and I said the downstream components of this directional information are these genes disheveled, or these gene products disheveled and prickle. So what we're looking at here is notochord cells in the process of intercalating. So this is muscle. So this is 1, 2, 3 images of the same embryo. This is just showing the cells, showing prickle localization, disheveled localization. This is the tail. This is the head. Same on all of these. So we want to get intercalation this way, not this way. So what we see is disheveled and prickle are membrane localized, so that's the boundary of a cell. And that we find it uniformly around the cells, except where they're in contact with the muscle cells out here. We don't find it there, but we find it here. We've also done, this is expressing a transgene. We've also done it where we have just scattered cells expressing it. So it's not simply the juxtaposition of two cells here that gives this. You can have an isolated cell here in the middle, and you see this, or an isolated cell there, and you see the same.
There? Underneath the shovel label, where it looks like it's not the membrane measurement, but the cytoplasmic?
Yeah, this is a confocal image, and they're sort of round. And so getting a single plane where you're going right through the middle of all cells and not looking at the top of a cell is not always possible. So I'm assuming that we're looking kind of at the top of a cell, so we're seeing membrane localization there, and then you kind of dip down and you're seeing through another cell there. We've looked at enough of these that, you know, we... Yeah, well, we haven't. And then, so the one thing, the thing that seems to be different is we're seeing disheveled and prickle co-localize, which is unusual.
But I thought that was also the case early on.
Right. But we don't see this later. And it seems, right. But this is the stage at which we're seeing polarization. So it seems to differ. And as I'll show you, where's this polarizing information coming from? Here's the muscle out here. And I'm going to show you in a second that muscle seems to be the source of the wind. This just shows a mutant. You don't see much here. It's no longer membrane localized, no polarity there, so on. It seems to be dead here. So the muscle cells, which are immediately surrounding the notochordals, here and here, the muscle cells seem to express this gene WNT5. And this is really another one of the beauties of the ascidian is they have very few, as I said, members of gene families. Vertebrates have 17, 18, who knows, depends on which animal you look at, members of this WNT family. The ascidians have only 3. So it's clear that we can look at all of them and we can see what cells are expressed, and this seems to make sense. And most recently, someone else has done a experiment to eliminate this gene product from here, and you disrupt notochord development. Really good question, yeah. It seems to be the orthologue of vertebrate WNT5, yeah. Of this one, of WNT5, I'm not sure. There seems to be 2 classes of WNT, one called the canonical and the non-canonical. This is a member of the non-canonical pathway. It's unclear whether there's non-canonical WNTs in Drosophila or there's some other ligand-like polarizing thing that gives that information. It's unclear. But ascidians seem to only have 1 of these non-canonical WNTs, where vertebrates have at least 3. So if we put this together, what we think is happening is this, that initially the cells kind of wiggle around, get captured, and what we think is that getting captured is making them polarized, and now they're putting out polarized lamellipodia this way, and it's that drives them together. So the question is, do they have to get captured in order for them to receive this WNT signal, right? So what would you predict? You would predict that if they didn't get captured, they would never receive this WNT signal, and the double mutant, so let's say you had neither this boundary here to get captured in, or this planar cell polarity pathway, you should be no worse than simply not having this. And that's not true. So when we made the double mutant, so prediction, we predict the double mutant should be no more severe. In fact, they are more severe. So this shows just wild type. Here's aimless, chimonge. So you can really see how these cells are kind of flat and crawling around. Then this is the double mutant here. And it really is more severe. And you can see when if you let these grow up, they really end up sick little puppies. So here's wild type. This is what, when they grow up, the tail, they still have a sort of a something you can pick out as the tail on both chimonga and aimless. It's really when you get rid of both of these components of the morphogenesis that the tail really collapses down and there's really nothing there. Despite this, these in a way are viable. Tissues are there, for example, this dark spot is part of their brain. They have muscle in here and so on. But it seems as though these really are somewhat separate phenomena. The border capture and planar cell polarity are at least semi-independent, meaning that, so for example, in Chimungue, if you also get rid of the planar cell polarity pathway, it gets more severe, meaning that these do seem to be receiving some polarized information from the muscle cells anyway, and then it's more severe here. The problem is motility is so universal that it would be hard to identify it as such. What you'd really want to have, and unfortunately you can't get as sophisticated in Ascidian as you can in Drosophila, where you can have tissue-specific mutations and so on. Not yet, not really. I mean, what you really want is conditional mutations, where you're only driving a mutation in certain tissues. You know, the technology exists, it's really partially just having the manpower to do that. Okay, let's see, how am I doing for time? Can I have time to talk about one more thing? I'll just, one more thing. So the other thing we're working on is the development of the nervous system. As I said, the Ascidian has sort of this chordate brain in miniature. And I said it's only 330 cells, and I was a little untruthful there because only a third of those are neurons. The other two-thirds are glial cells, which are supportive cells of the nervous system. They're nerve cells, but they don't actually send action potentials and so on. Yet, the way the Ascidian brain and the vertebrate brain are laid out in their development is very similar. And you don't find this, for example, in Drosophila and nematodes and so on. Those are hundreds of millions of years separated. These are much more closely related. So, for example, this just shows gene expression patterns as an example of how much parallel there is between the two. For example, the OTX, which is expressed here, which is just a forebrain. I'll show this in a minute. You see that here. Genes expressed in the midbrain, hindbrain, spinal cord, and so on, all the way down. So this shows the basic layout of the nervous system. There's this structure called the sensory vesicle, which is equivalent to our forebrain and midbrain, contains these two pigmented structures. I showed you those on the last slide. Part of them, this one here, is equivalent to our pigmented retinal epithelia. It's just dark cup-shaped cells in which the photoreceptors lie, and this shields the photoreceptors from stray light. And then this is a kind of a unique organ that allows them to sense gravity, because they live in a three-dimensional world, and you want to make sure you don't swim to the bottom of the ocean, so because there's nobody down there, right? So they want to stay fairly shallow, and that's how they sense gravity with this. So this is their central nervous system. Midbrain-hindbrain junction, hindbrain, spinal cord, and then a number of sensory systems out here, tetraceptors out here, tetraceptors here in the peripheral nervous system, possibly chemoreceptors, and more tetraceptors. Really pretty simple, but it does a trick for them. They get sensory information, they integrate it, and then they swim in particular directions in response to these cues. So I'm just going to show you a mutant and why Ascidians are so good for studying this kind of thing. This is a mutant that we actually found just swimming around in the Santa Barbara Yacht Harbor. There's really millions of them down in the Yacht Harbor. And people want you to get them off their boat, so people are happy to let you collect them. I didn't really talk about the genetics of these, but they are hermaphrodites. So the adults are male and female, and they're self-fertilizing hermaphrodites, which is unusual. But it makes for screening for recessive mutations very easily, because you can get them to self-fertilize, and then you can look for recessive mutations in one generation, a lot like C. elegans. So we found this one just by self-fertilizing animals we picked off someone's boat, and exactly one quarter of them, as you would predict by if you ever had basic genetics, had this phenotype here. Here's a normal one, here's those pigmented cells, this is called a palp. So these ones had no pigmented sensory structures, no palps, which is this glue-like organ at the very anterior end. That this is what they're using to stick to the bottom of your boat. Otherwise, they're pretty normal. As I'll show you, they're missing half their brain, but still they can kind of swim around, and they're doing pretty surprisingly well. It's lethal that they won't get very far past this, but they make it this far, and they swim around. We also noted this odd structure up here, which you don't find here. Can't tell you what the gene is, but just basically what we're finding is all of the ectodermal derivatives. Remember that first slide I showed you that there's this ectoderm, which is one of the primary germ layers, encapsulates the embryo, and that gives rise to skin and to nervous system. That's important, skin and nervous system. And all of these anterior ectodermal derivatives, anterior from sort of about here, is completely missing. So the question is, one, are they completely gone? Did they become something else? What happened to them? So here's a wild type, meaning a normal one. Here's the forming sensory structures here, forming sensory structures all around here, spinal cord down here, here's the forebrain, so on. So what we find is everything anterior from here is gone. So all of this, and then there's this knob here. So what happened? One possibility is that they simply received the wrong kind of polarizing information. And again, so polarizing comes in that you have to know your front end is different than your back end. And there's all sorts of mutations where you can just shift everything backwards and everything becomes more posterior. Doesn't seem to be the case. If we look at this gene here called OTX, we find it here in the brain and then up here at the forming skin. It's still here. So these cells know, at least by expressing this gene, they're demonstrating, they know that they're at the front end of the embryo. So it's not as though they've become something more posterior. And things, for example, this is just a gene that's going to be expressed where the mouth forms. It's not there. So definitely a transfading of cells to become something else. And sure enough, that didn't, well, should be a little darker. If we follow the fates of cells, we can show what's happened here. Actually, is it possible to make that one? Oh well. We got every other one. Ah, okay. Does that help? So can you see that though there's sort of red cells there. These are cells that are carrying a lineage tracer. So what we've done is gone into this very early embryo at the 32-cell stage, and we've poked a couple cells and put a dye in there that doesn't kill them, and they can grow up, and we can find out where that dye ends up. And I just wanted to show you this because this gets back to that fixed lineage. So here at the 32-cell stage, we can say that this A65 cell here, and this just shows the descendants of that cell, will give rise to this sensory vesicle, this structure here, the palp, this structure here, stomatodeum is just a fancy name for mouth, and palp here. So all of these cells here, we label A65 and let them grow up. Here are all the descendants of that cell much later. So if we label that same cell in the mutant, we find is them all piled up right here. I don't show this, but when we go in and find out what type of cells these are skin cells, also known as epidermis. So what seems to have happened in this mutation is right here that this A65 should have become neural type tissue. In fact, it stayed the same fate as its sister cell and went on to become skin, which is piled up here, not knowing what to do, but skin is just going to want to be on the outside, and so it stays on the outside. What's the gene responsible for this? I don't know. We're working on it right now. I'm showing this mainly just so you can see that how powerful this lineage is in ascidians. This kind of thing is not possible in any sort of vertebrate. There's too many cells, much too complicated. But to have a real fate transformation that can go back to lineage is really unique for this one kind of chordate. So anyway, that's sort of where we're at now. These are people currently in the lab, three graduate students, Nathan Silva, Jason Tresser, Lisa Beluzzi. Three postdocs are working on this, Matthew Caracas, D. Jang, Shota Chiba. A lot of this was done by people who have since moved on. Thank you.